then I thank the organizers for having me here at this workshop. This is a very nice place, and I'm very happy to be here. I'm going to talk about a little project that we think relieves some of the tension between getting high-scale inflation models that predict primordial gravitational waves and models with low-energy supersymmetry for particle phenomenology that could be tested at the LHC. As you will see soon, there was a tension formulated by Renata Kalos and André Linde in the most clear way, and we think we can resolve the tension. This is work done with Shamit Kachru and Temple He from, I mean, both here in Stanford. So this is what is it doing? This is where I'm going to take you. So I will first tell you why we want high-scale models of inflation, why they are large field if they are high scale, and why in that case in particular we want in the end a string theory embedding, why string theory is kind of better to have in order to discuss such models instead of just effective field theory. And then why then therefore coming from string theory or better at supergravity approximation the tension arises. And the tension, I will tell you how what this Kalos-Linde problem exactly is. It was mentioned by Taizan 2 days ago in his discussion. That's the first point. The tension between low-scale SUSY and high-scale inflation. And then I will tell you how we think we can get around the problem. So let me first tell you where we are when it comes to observational cosmology. This is the 7-year WMAP data on the cosmological microwave background temperature power spectrum. You see that they can constrain two parameters that are characteristic for inflationary models of early universe expansion. One is the spectral tilt of the power spectrum of density fluctuations, NS, and the other one is the relative magnitude in primordial gravitational waves called R. And you see that they place constraints which are not yet as good in R, but as you can see, in the next 5 years, this will be about the improvement in the errors in both quantities, coming from Planck and BICEP2, which are now taking data. The successor to BICEP2 has been basically funded and is under construction, will take up measurements probably this year, and will increase again the sensitivity compared to BICEP2 by a factor of 4. So all these will come down to errors in R about that size in about 5 years. And Planck will narrow down in S, and probably also R in the same kind of amount. So we will be able to start to discriminate among even like effective field theory models. So when it comes to these things, we basically live in a kind of golden age of observational cosmology. We can hope to start to test models of inflation at least and see what they teach us about their basic, the underlying structure of the theory. So let me shortly recapitulate, although probably everybody has seen this all over here already, what inflation is. Inflation is a period of quasi-exponential expansion of the very early universe. It is needed to solve certain initial condition problems associated with the usual hot Big Bang. If you may remember when we sit here, this is us now, 13.7 billion years, and we look backwards, our backward light cone to the point of the surface of last scattering where the CMB was formed. This is about like 400,000 years, yeah? So we sit here and you see what kind of light cone could have reached from the initial singularity, it would have been there. This is tiny compared to the size that we see. There are many patches that would have been without causal contact. There's no reason why all this area should be so homogeneous and isotropic in temperature. Why the whole universe should be homogeneous and isotropic at all at large scales. So an inflation is so far the best studied way that solves this problem. By having a period of exponential expansion that shows you that all of what is in here, and maybe even much more, could have been originated in one causally connected very tiny patch. So inflation itself is driven by the vacuum energy of a slowly rolling light scalar field. What that means is that if you find a scalar potential such that the second derivative of the field becomes unimportant and the equation of motion is reduced to this part, so-called slow roll equation of motion, then the potential energy of the field is dominating over its kinetic energy. And it behaves roughly like a cosmological constant, which then drives exponential expansion. It becomes a quasi-Dirichlet spacetime. So that's exactly what I said. When the second derivative is you can neglect it compared to the first derivative. If you find a scalar potential that leads to such an evolution of the scalar field, then you get quasi-exponential expansion. And this condition, and the condition that the kinetic energy is subdominant compared to the potential energy, you can reframe in terms of conditions on the scalar potential. You calculate its first derivative weighted by the potential itself and the second derivative. These parameters, epsilon and eta, are called the so-called slow roll parameters. If they are much smaller than unity, then the scalar field will slowly roll, meaning its equation of motion is given by these two terms, and you can drop the second derivative. And then you have potential energy domination, and therefore a phase of expansion that is driven by a quasi-cosmological constant. So beyond there are several quantities that we can use to test the generic predictions of inflationary theory. And they all rest on the fact that inflation, in its quasi-Dirichlet phase of expansion, the exponential expansion, generates fluctuations, quantum fluctuations of the scalar field that are stretched to enormously long wavelengths and then become basically classical. And they source perturbations of the metric of the gravitational field, so-called metric perturbations. And they are mainly, inflation itself sources only two modes. One are the scalar modes, which are like direct fluctuations in the, if you want, in the Newtonian gravitational potential on spatial slices in the universe. These lead directly to fluctuations of density, which follows the gravitational potential. And they, therefore, are the seed for structure formation. We all, if you want, if this theory is correct, inflation theory is correct, we are all result of these scalar fluctuations. They have seeded us all at the end. In addition, so the magnitude of these scalar fluctuations you can calculate by quantizing first the scalar field, the inflaton in the Dirichlet background, and then coupling it to gravity and see how the fluctuations of the scalar field transform into fluctuations of the metric. The formula, the relation is given that they are measured by the size of the Hubble constant during inflation, squared divided by the slow roll parameter. So basically by the ratio of the scalar potential with the slow roll parameter epsilon. And what you find when you calculate, and you calculate their Fourier decomposition, the power spectrum, then you find that most models of inflation generically predict that this power spectrum is nearly flat. They have equal power on all scales, meaning that you can define a quantity in S that I did not note before on the observational constraint slide that is nearly unity. If it's unity, then it will be exactly flat. Now, since it's the data points to that this is a bit less than unity, it means that the spectrum has a slight red tilt. It means it has a little bit more power on long wavelengths than on small wavelengths. And then there are the tensor modes. Inflationary fluctuations generically couple also to those modes in the metric that are gravitational waves. That's, for instance, different than in models like periodic scenarios of the very early universe, because they generically don't predict the existence of these modes. And the thing what you see here is, when you calculate them, is the power that is in these modes and these gravitational waves is directly proportional to the scale of inflation, of the inflationary potential. There is no slow roll parameter epsilon. So should you measure the magnitude of these waves, you know immediately where the scale of inflation was. This is a direct window to high scale physics.
Actually, that's not quite true. It doesn't really matter what you're saying. I mean, it's possible to have a gas of stuff around during inflation that also generates gravity waves.
Okay. Granted, I should make the exception.
There are some degeneracies still.
That is true. One should probably say the strongest thing you get in the context of relatively simple single field inflationary models, there the link is direct.
Also, with this apoiotic prediction, is it really understood well enough to make a prediction one way or the other? Does anyone know? It's often stated this way that model predicts no gravity waves, but there's the singularity in the middle of the evolution, and how, you know, what do we really know about what it does or doesn't predict?
Well,
One point is that it's a zigzag.
Well, so how did you, you know?
You can get anything through the zigzag.
Well, that's what, exactly, that's, but it's often set this way, and there's no, like, gravity waves, so I never really understood how.
I think what.
Some specific assumptions of continuation through the singularity.
That may be one thing. The other thing, maybe because they never have an exponential expansion, they never have a de Sitter stage. They don't get them from the usual production mechanism in exponentially expanding.
Well, that's for sure. They don't have the inflationary.
Yeah, mechanism. Yeah. So, and therefore, that mechanism is not there. I think that maybe that's what they were referring to.
Okay. But
so,
there could be some wildly.
If something happens in the bounce, so to speak, right, or in this whatever, I mean, the approaching phase is effectively contracting, right, and then you bounce and come back. I mean, what happens in the bounce, I think no one knows. So that is a caveat, of course. But when it comes to what you generate after the bounce, once you are back in the semi-classical regime, where here you generate these long wavelength fluctuations also in the gravitational wave modes of the metric, they don't have that part.
What about string gas cosmology?
They have a bounce as far as it's the same kind of thing, right? They get a shrink and then a bouncing into another expanding phase with no exponential regime. So that mechanism wouldn't be there. What they do in the bounce is the same question. I don't know.
What about the spectral field? Is it blue shifted or red shifted?
You mean the, of scalar perturbations?
A lot of Brandman who talk on this, I thought he maybe claimed that there were gravity waves and they had a red. There was something distinctive about their tail. I don't know
For what? For ekpyrotic or for?
No, this is for the string gas. He had some claim, again, just a claim. I don't know the basis of the claim, but that.
The spectral tilt of gravity waves. Yeah, I think they claimed that it had a blue tilt or something like that, right? That.
Perhaps a blue tilt. Yeah.
Yeah, I think a blue tilt. They claimed if you see nothing at the long wavelength regime, but you see something at much smaller. Of cosmological origin and not of what coming from some whatever black hole mergers or something like. Then they would have like, I mean, confirmation that NT, spectral index of T is blue, and that would be basically ruling out inflation.
Yeah, again, it was hard to see what the inputs versus outputs were.
Yeah.
But anyways.
Also the magnitude of fluctuations, did they have any place to get that from?
I don't know, I got confused earlier on.
So maybe it's safe to phrase it like this. As long as we continue to have evidence that the data that we have is consistent with the description with a simple single scalar field model of inflation, and if we then, in that context, we measure a non-zero NS and a non-zero power of gravitational waves, then probably it would be relatively safe to interpret this as having measured the scale of inflation. Unless you have further evidence that you need more complicated setups. So what you really can measure in data is not exactly directly, I mean, you cannot just directly, I mean, what people quote is not directly the power in gravitational waves, they quote the ratio of this power to the power in the scalar mode of density, that you see the density fluctuations. This is the ratio R, the relative amount that they have. And there is a relation for, at least for single field inflationary models, going back to David Leith, that tells you how much of this ratio you get in terms of how far the field moves during inflation, the canonically normalized scalar field in terms of in Planck units. And what you see is there is kind of a boundary here that if the field moves sub-Planckian, you get an R, we will not get an R that's bigger than 0.01. And if you move more than a Planck distance, then you get bigger R. When I remind you of the slide that we have seen earlier, this one here, then you see that 0.01 is like roughly the best we can hope in the next 5 years. So kind of the best hope for measurement accuracy seems to be realizable in the next 5 years goes to the point where you test more, they test exactly this boundary between super-Planckian and sub-Planckian motion. So once we have this boundary, then if we want to produce are bigger than 0.01, we have to find models where the field moves more than a Planck distance. And then we run immediately into the problem that if you have some scalar potential that drives inflation, and it should do it for field motions more than a Planck distance, you'd expect generically from an ineffective field theory that dimension 6 operators will generate your corrections to the scalar potential that are as big as the potential you wrote down. In particular, this type of correction, if you take its second derivative to compute the second Thoreau parameter epsilon, gives a correction to epsilon, which is to eta, which is order 1. When it's order 1, it means that your slow roll condition is broken. So these kind of corrections over super Planckian distances destroy slow roll unless you were able to control them. And since you have many of them, and even higher series, I mean higher dimension operators, you better have a symmetry that controls all of them, or it forbids them if possible. This idea is old, but in order to, it goes back to André Linde, but in order to realize that you need some UV completion of any kind of model of inflation. And that, I mean, one UV completion that we can talk about is string theory, which is why there is some motivation if you want to build models of inflation that generate gravity waves in a measurable magnitude, that then you better, that then you can, string theory is one possible path to go in order to try to realize them. So we have in recent years, we had some success with Eva, who is here, and Liam McAllister in constructing models of inflation, like axial monodromy and the monodromy inflation with the four bands in type 2a, where you use basically breaking of periodicity that most of the scalar fields of string theory typically have by a monodromy, in order to generate large field potentials that have either linear or fractional power. And these predict then that some gravity waves of a magnitude will become testable in the next years. So this is the background. You see where this basically, if you would imagine that the future data put some ellipses there, you see that you can really start to separate between models. Of course, not perfectly, but better than nothing. So now, on that background, I will review the tension that we have, in particular for these high-scale inflationary models that sit roughly at the gut scale and then can produce gravitational waves that we might be able to measure, and low-energy supersymmetry. So the tension comes roughly from this kind of path of inputs and what follows from that. So if we wish for low-energy supersymmetry, let's say like in string theory, then the easiest way to get that is that you compactify the internal space on the Calabi-Yau manifold, because you get a covariantly constant spinner from heterotic string theory. In type 2b, you have two. You need an oriented folding, but this is the path where you basically preserve supersymmetry at low scales, at tree level. Now, the problem with Calabi-Yau spaces is that they have a bunch of scalar fields describing their deformations of shape and sizes, the moduli fields, which you have to remove. We don't want to have 100 scalar fields flying around at low energies. It's not our universe. So one path to controlled compactification, controlled means you stabilize the internal manifold, you make all these deformation modes massive, is that you fix, has been found in type 2b string theory. You can fix there the shapes with so-called fluxes of background gauge, higher p-form gauge fields, flux compactifications, and then you fix the sizes. That was the original idea, with basically trying to find non-perturbative effects, for instance, Gaugino condensation on stacks of coincident brains, that give you instanton effects, basically one instanton per size modulus. And as you will see in a simple example, that will lead to led to stabilization of those moduli too. So how this works in principle. Of course. That's why I said it was the first.
It was the first guess.
You can do better. Okay. I mean, and you can do with one instanton, you fix all of them, which is a much better. Constantine showed that, and Forker showed that. But as I said, this was historically the first way where they finally managed to get all of them fixed.
Sorry, what is
you had a talk by Michael Brown last week. It's a recent paper also by.
They had this setup where they had you fix the. Oh, sorry. I mean, you can also.
These things are the easiest.
Yeah. And there's this one ampoule divisor, which stabilizes all the moduli. So you don't have to have 100 exponential terms. Just a single exponential term.
can stabilize the whole.
Yeah. In simple, you know, layman's word, one could say if you have exponent that has all the coefficient of canonical moduli of the same negative sign, then you can minimize potential with respect to each of these modulus because
yes.
of the signs conspiring to be on it. And that's related to ample divisors. Mm-hmm.
So that might be also related to this problem, is that then when you add more, you can start to do the necessary adjustments to change the Susie breaking scale.
Well, I would still think that in general, because we have the one exponential there, there is still this one barrier, as you will see, that will give the rise to the same problem. Whenever you have an exponential still in the game, I think you run into the same problem. And the problem you see in the simple case of one exponential for one modulus, this is where you can, like, I mean, see the game in the simplest form. What the so-called background fluxes do is they remove all the complex structure moduli from the master spectrum, effective master spectrum in the end, and they generate a VEF for the superpotential. So with only that, you would have a so-called no-scale compactification because all the volume moduli, here I have only one of them for representation T, would be still massless. But then if on that volume, on that full cycle in the Calabi-Yau, each volume modulus is associated with a full cycle, some four-dimensional subspace of the six-dimensional Calabi-Yau. If you wrap a stack of seven brains, so it's like basically you have some kind of Calabi-Yau, if you wrap on one of these cycles, if you wrap a stack of seven brains, you will get Gaugino condensation because there's a gauge theory there, 4dn equals one gauge theory in the end, and after compactification. And that will generate an exponential contribution to the superpotential. And now you see that you will have that the F term has now a zero for a given value on T, and that produces a minimum of the scalar potential, which is anti-de-Sitter. So this volume modulus is then stabilized. Now you have to break supersymmetry. The original idea proposed by KKLT was that you add in a warped region of the manifold, you add an anti-de-free plane. You can have other sources of supersymmetry breaking too. You need something in order to lift this vacuum because we don't live in anti-de-Sitter space. So what happens is that inflation now itself is a source of supersymmetry breaking. It generates positive vacuum energy, otherwise we don't get the exponential expansion. And any source of positive vacuum energy necessarily breaks supersymmetry. So what happens is that when you add any sector that breaks supersymmetry, it doesn't really matter whether it's inflation or you first the anti-D3 when it lifts you to zero and then inflation in addition, they all, after rescaling into Einstein frame, 4D Einstein frame, they scale as an inverse power of the volume of the internal space. So if you parametrize it, let's say it's an F term, then you see that breaks supersymmetry. And you see that because this inverse scaling comes, if you want, in terms of the supergravity scalar potential, it comes from the factor e to the k, which gives you inverse powers of the volume. So if you add more and more vacuum energy because you want to push above zero during inflation, what you see is that because this scale is an inverse power of the volume, you cannot add arbitrarily much. You can, pictorially speaking, roughly as much as this barrier was when you go to zero vacuum energy, maybe 10 times more. But then you lose the minimum for the volume modulus. You're going to run away.
Well, one question that is actually. Yeah. So this single divisor for everyone, does it give the same mass to all the moduli?
No, there's one large mass, which is roughly for, I mean, this modulus corresponds to the breathing mode of the divisor.
Okay.
And then there's n minus one light ones that are volume preserved.
So those ones will be very sensitive to this uplifting because, I mean, the bond that you have is much smoother. I mean, if you just have enough energy, happens like what is shown in the graph, but much heavier for the lighter stabilized moduli. He's adding energy here, mm-hmm. and so he's forming the potential.
Mm-hmm.
The lighter the mass, the sooner it will be destabilized, and this uplifting will not work.
What you want to say is that the mass here is kind of tied to the height of the.
This cup here is the mass.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So if you have very light moduli, this mechanism will be very sensitive to this.
I think the barrier is actually pretty much the same for all of them. If you draw, I'll draw it in two dimensions. I'll draw it on the blackboard.
I mean, it would be, do you want now to draw it now? Because then we can at least, I mean, I would like to see it too, Alder.
No, no, well, I mean.
So, suppose you have two moduli. So along this direction, let's say tau 1 equals tau 2. Then the shape of the potential is roughly like this, after the output. And then in this direction, it goes roughly like this. So you have something like that. So it's like a little pocket here. So in this direction, it's less steep. So these masses. So this direction corresponds to tau 1 plus tau 2 equals constant, which is the volume of the ample divisor. So if you move in this direction, the volume stays constant, and then if you move in this direction, then you change the volume. So this guy is about a factor of 100 times heavier. And then, so this guy is about probably roughly 2 times the barrier kilo mass, and then this one is about maybe 200 times the barrier kilo mass.
How high do you have to,
but
can
this,
you go here?
This barrier is roughly, I mean, if you want to go outside this way or this way, it's pretty much the same, the height.
You mean if you go in this direction as high as the barrier is here in that direction, you lose the barrier?
Yeah,
for
you lose the barrier when you
the diagonal direction.
Jump out this way, or you can jump out this way, but it's the same.
Yeah, so in that sense, the problem remains, basically. You have the same kind of behavior still. As long as you have one exponential in the game, and you play the game with small w naught, so you still have this kind of quote-unquote KKRT-like regime, you have this problem.
How about raised tracks? Here you balance with constant, small constant versus exponent.
In raised track, I think the height of the barrier is higher.
Well, I think that was
only one exponential you can avoid.
Yeah, that was basically to avoid this problem. One idea in the original paper by Renata and Andre was that they actually add a second exponential. So they add to this one, which I already wrote, they add something like this. Right? So this looks like a real, like a racetrack, with the exception that they have this constant still. The racetrack by itself is able to stabilize t without the supergravity corrections. The partial derivative of w has a zero already. So that would already stabilize in global supersymmetry t. But now you can use this to adjust the minimum of the potential to basically zero, and also the van of w to zero. So what they can do is they can fine-tune away the depth of the ADS in that minimum, and therefore they can basically fine-tune the gravitational mass in that minimum to zero. But it is a fine-tuned way to do that. It doesn't come automatically.
They cannot make it a zeter by tuning.
They
zeter.
No, for the zeter, they still need some kind of uplift. But the uplift could be, I mean, they could fine-tune this, that the overall VAF in the minimum is, say, 10 to the minus 15 in Planck units. And then they only need a very highly warped entity three brain to push that to zero. The point is that they can maintain always by fine-tuning that this vanishes approximately, while the barrier generated from the potential coming from the two terms is very high. And at that moment, this link is broken. But it comes at the cost of fine tuning.
So you basically decouple the gravitational mass
from the barrier. Exactly, yeah.
Well,
the barrier height.
Is really, this is a general analysis of all this microbial data. Right, where they point out that what's relevant is the ratio of H to M3 halves at the point where impression starts.
Mm-hmm.
So the M3 halves at that point need not have any simple relation to the M3 halves that we measured.
Thank you. That's the whole main idea of the rest. You just basically kept my talk short. I will just show you a mechanism how to do that. But that's exactly the idea. You have to break the link that M3 halves after inflation and M3 halves during inflation have necessarily to be the same. This solution keeps M3 halves, so to speak. I mean, the M3 halves coming that you would infer solely from the moduli potential, it will keep it the same, in a sense. And the only exchange you get that M3 halves is, of course, bigger because of the F term from inflation. But the moduli potential doesn't depend on whether you add this. I mean, its contribution to M3 half doesn't really depend a lot on whether you add inflation. So now I move backwards. That's not what I wanted. I was here, right? So, so what to do is exactly what Chanta already said, is we have to get the Gravitino mass kind of, we have to remove it from being fixed. We have to get it kind of rolling, adjusting together with the motion of the inflaton. Meaning that, pictorially speaking, we should kind of have, during inflation, we should have the height of the barrier being adjusting and scaling with the vacuum energy of inflation, such that the barrier is never lost, regardless whether the inflation potential is high or low. And in order to do that, in the very simple model of where you have, you started a simple setup where we have just, one modulus and one exponential. In this setup from that KKLT-like, where you could imagine doing that, if you would have a way to have this constant that sets the depth of the ADS before lifting, and therefore also the barrier after lifting, the barrier height. But if you have this constant adjusting with the inflationary motion as a function of the inflaton field. So if this would have a piece that's not flux generated, but basically contains the inflationary sector, such that it becomes big or small, depending on where the inflaton is, such that the barrier is never really lost. And that's what this kind of toy setup achieves. So what we have done here is basically we have split up part of the superpotential that's not a function of the volume modulus T in a part that's really coming from fluxes and a part that is the inflationary sector. And to make to have a model where the original tension would have been particularly stark is, you see that this model gives rise to some effective large field model of inflation. It has a power law potential. Therefore, the Kähler potential of this field was chosen to be shift symmetric. Otherwise, we have no radiative control over the potential. So I will show you why we need these extra field acts. This is necessary in order to avoid the original problem. And the fact is that, that given the symmetries that you see in the Kähler potential, that phi has a shift symmetry, x has no symmetry at all that constrains it, and phi in addition has an R symmetry under the R charge of the superpotential of 2 over n. This is kind of, in the end, it's a technically natural model. Any addition of a function of x, or functions of x, g and f, here, beyond the first basically the term here that should be of order unity, and the first two terms here with order unity coefficients are allowed and will not destroy the dynamics of the model in the end. So this is not some particular choice. This is a relatively general.
If you include module independence and carrier potential for those fields, is it still going to be okay?
You mean for these fields?
Yeah.
And, it won't change it. It won't change it. We check that. If there's some like 1/T or whatever, right?
So this is, at this point, you're transitioning to a sort of bottom-up description, is that right?
Yeah, this is a bottom-up. This model has no direct string description because, in general, we have no model that gives us directly a superpotential with such a functional form, in particular not for larger powers of n.
Take the string theory form for T.
Yeah, but the point is that the whole problem already arises. This whole problem arises already, from the form of the supergravity potential for moduli stabilization. You don't the input that you use from string theory is the form of the contributions to the superpotential that fix these fields, the volume fields T. But once you have that, you are left with the problem. You can study the removal of the problem. I mean, you can already ask what possibilities you have in supergravity.
Actually, if you are just making a statement about supergravity, I was wondering why you necessarily want the minus 3 log p plus mu bar. On the other hand, if you're saying that this is coming from string theory, then
we don't have a construction string theory that gives precisely this form of the Kähler potential. What we know is that we have fields in string theory that have to leading order a Kähler potential of this form. There are axionic superfields called, they basically are made up by, for instance, an example, like the integrals over B2 plus the integral over C2 over some two cycle, or a set of two cycles, yeah?
So these are coming from open string modes?
These are coming from?
They are coming from open string, from B-brain,
closed?
No, these are closed string. This is the Neve-Schwarz axion, and this is the two-form Amont-Amont axion. Okay. You integrate them over
so
two cycles.
So why is that coming from that?
They could be. This is one possible candidate. I said we don't have an explicit model, but these fields, G, that are labeled here, have a Kähler potential in orientifold compactifications of type 2B. The leading term goes like G plus G bar, bracket square. They have a shift symmetry. I mean, we use the imaginary party already for these axial monotropy models. You can use them to build inflation with a linear potential.
The Kähler potential may be okay, but you're saying you can't justify too well this power phi to the n.
Large power. I mean, the models that we had, because the potential comes from an NS5 brain, we don't have a description in terms of a function W for this potential. Maybe it is possible if you can make a transition into a dual flux description or something like that. But
I mean, it's fine, right? The way the subject developed in the past, there were field theory models from the bottom up that were radiatively stable, chaotic inflation being one. And then it takes longer to understand how that idea manifests itself at all in string theory. So here you're just taking the first step. I don't see a problem, I was just asking it.
No, that exactly. I mean, we see that the problem with these fact that inflationary F terms tend to uplift too strong is already in the supergravity limit of the compactification. And you can ask then, are there simple toy models of large field inflation that overcome this problem that they tend to destabilize the T-modulus?
But wouldn't you expect that this field, if you identify this field with phi, then you would expect that this field has a shift symmetry that you only get instant transformations between the time terms and not polynomial.
No, you don't only get instanton terms.
You don't only get instanton terms. The other thing is, I mean, the instanton would be a function first of the volume of some cycle, yeah? So you could have an instanton generated.
They are always coming together with a true instanton, you know, which you can scale with the volume.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. But still, I mean, you could imagine that some kind of stringy instanton generate kind of your power couplings this way, if you want, right?
Which term are you worrying about?
I was understanding that you wanted to identify phi, not x phi with this axionic field.
I said this is a potential.
Axionic fields generically have a monotony. That's part of what you can get.
So they have a shift symmetry, and usually it's a top rank into discrete symmetry, and so you...
Usually, actually, it's broken earlier by monotony effects from brains or fluxes. Mm-hmm. And what he's saying is that hasn't yet been described, packaged as a symmetric form. It's
yes.
A phenomenon is actually more generic than the one that you're describing. But
this field, for instance.
If you're saying this polynomial dependence comes from such a...
Well, it's generally not polynomial. It's generally some fractional power.
Fractional polynomial, if you want. Yeah.
And this is trying to abstract the Kalish-Lindner problem into a field theory problem and then solving it.
Exactly. We don't claim that this is a string theory version of solving this problem. It's a version of solving in supergravity, the problem which already exists in supergravity given the form for the volume moduli, Kähler potential and superpotential.
Sorry, I didn't mean just
to... No. I mean, this should be a discussion. I'm not here to...
You need axes? Could you just do it more in the abstract or with this x
You mean this X field you mean? We need that. That's something I will explain. You need it. This is crucial. We need that because it will be the F term of that field that will generate the potential for inflation. It will not be F phi. This is the crucial thing. If you would use F phi, you run into the old problem. Yeah.
So you wrote that phi is the integral of two plus ic two, right?
I said this is a candidate for I mean, because this is not a string construction, I cannot yet say whether this is for this specific form. This has to be like the G field, right?
Because B2 also has a shift symmetry, right?
So no, B2 doesn't have a shift symmetry in oriented fold compactification. It explicitly appears in the Kähler potential. When you write it out in the way how the oriented fold splits the chiral multiplets, I mean, splits the n equals 2 multiplets in terms of 4 cycle volumes and these G fields, you find that your Kähler potential for a, this was done by Grimm and Lewis originally, for a single, let's say, you have a single, single volume modulus in some of these G fields, or one of them for the moment. So this, I hope the minus sign is correct. I hope I do this in the right way. It behaves like this with some constant here in front, which is like with GS and
other. So the point is that T is not the volume. T is the volume plus B squared or something.
Exactly, exactly. The physical volume, so to speak. I mean, when you express that, you took the original volume, which is like, you know, within the section numbers, it's like in terms of these two cycle volumes, yeah? And then you have a relation with, I mean, the TA are given by, or TA, by kappa ABC, VA, VB, VC, yeah? Plus terms that go like G times G plus G bar. And when you put that in and you express this in terms of these fields and these fields, then you get that the G's appear. You see that the imaginary part doesn't appear, but the real part, which is B, is there. Using B would generate this way immediate an eta problem. You get corrections for the one to the eta parameter. I mean, at most it has a discrete one, right? If I remember that correctly. But this one doesn't have a shift symmetry at all. No, I mean, the split under the oriented fold kills it.
I mean, you could just add a harmonic two form to me, any arbitrary harmonic two form. That would be your GH.
So the problem here is that the Euclidean three ring that is basically being used is come into the e to the minus t as a DBI action, which depends not just on the volume but also on b squared,
mm-hmm.
And that's where the b squared is basically coming in.
But if it's one of these famous O1,
in pairs of we have, right? There's B and F there. So the whole thing should be gauge invariant, not just B by itself.
Globally, the whole thing is gauge invariant, but you're working somewhere in field space and specific. And what it's being said here is just that the thing that KKLT fixes is T.
It's, yeah, and not T plus this combination. You fix, I mean, the holomorphic fields that appear in the instantons are T, not this whole thing.
Sure.
So if you fix T and then you write out the scalar potential, this thing gives you dependence on B.
A similar thing happens if you have space filling rings where there's, you know, boundary in the world sheet and things depend on B. So the shift symmetry is usually weakly broken by such.
But why shift symmetry breaks only in scalar potential but it doesn't break in scalar? Like in scalar it still shifts symmetry.
Well, I bet you're right that it's more generally broken in both.
I mean, the shift symmetry. The shift symmetry in the Kähler potential is broken non-perturbatively.
No, but here in W it's already broken perturbatively, right? You can't shift phi anymore.
No, the assumption is that this thing will be generated by some instanton effect.
Oh, you're saying f of x is also instanton effect? No.
There is a hidden dependence on some instanton that I haven't, for this effective model, haven't written down.
Does it have to be an instanton? Also, there's another t tilde in front of it. Like, alpha is exponent of some other minus t tilde?
Could be, well, would be one possibility,
okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not, I mean, we don't have any, as I said, I mean, you can speculate about these possibilities. We don't have an explicit model how to generate such a power law term directly.
It could be instanton, it could just be a spiritual brain.
It could be also brains, yeah. It could be once you would find, for instance, if you maybe you find one day a way to package the brain generated monotomy potential in terms of a W function, and then you would expect something like this to appear. Right? I mean, the shift symmetry breaking terms for these axion fields, like the Randamon axions, they have a shift symmetry that is exact to all orders and perturbation theory. This is why perturbative films will not kill this shift symmetric form in K. And the things, they are protected from the world sheet, except if the world sheet has is either describes an instanton or has boundaries, meaning it ends on the world on the brain. And that's the way we have been using that.
So there's no general statement. I mean, again, you don't have a candidate and so on, but
yeah.
Assuming that it's not a general statement, if these fields should appear in the superpotential actual level or not, like Keller versus contrapotential modulus.
These are part of the n equals 2 Keller moduli space.
So
they will not appear perturbatively in the sense of, you know, like whatever loop effects or something like that in the superpotential.
Okay, so then it's not perturbative because we were saying that it could be many things.
Yeah, I mean, it can be either such a term, if this phi is such a G field, it can come either from an instanton or, let's say, from the D planes that we already models that we already studied.
Or generalized flux squares, right? I mean, that's the U and Jung square tension.
That could also be once you move away from an ISD condition. Yeah.
Exactly. Such thing, it ends up depending on physical volumes through the conversion to Einstein, right? Which is, I guess, the U and the K.
Mm-hmm. It would be, I mean, non-ISD fluxes would be one way to also generate potentials that don't see periodicity.
But anyway, this is just a field theory mentioned, so maybe we should let you go on.
Well, that's okay. I mean, I'm happy to discuss because I would like to have mechanism, a construction for this. I don't have that. But at least from the supergravity perspective, this captures at least some of the features you might hope that would model string theory versions of large field inflation in the end.
And maybe last thing, you know,
they run into the problem. Sorry.
You deal with the powers, right?
Yeah.
What I heard from other people saying, it's more natural to expect to be exponential function. No. Okay, fine. Let's go.
A model for this is V wedge F quantity squared. That's not an exponential.
Yeah. I mean, at the moment you talk about monodromies, you expect powers. Maybe fractional, maybe integer. But exponentials you wouldn't get from monodromies.
I mean, the problem with the exponentials is that they tend to get sinusoidal terms, which are like what you need for something like natural inflation,
mm-hmm.
But the problem is the range of the field is too small for that.
It's not Planckian.
So you don't want the periodic potential impact. You want
that is true. You don't get the field range because the axion decay constants that you have in these, they are always sub-Planckian. No one has ever, found a model where you get them super Planckian, really.
Is it in the context of getting the high R to see the tensor mode?
The
if you don't want to require to see the tensor mode, you just want to solve.
Oh, of course. I mean, if you are happy with a TV scale model of inflation, right? That is consistent with TV scale moduli stabilization. If you want to be extreme, I mean, you can do that, right? I mean, that if you find then some way after reheating to still generate baryon asymmetry and so on from a TV scale reheating temperature, you might be able to do that. But then you will never see any R. Any tensor mode fraction R. Right?
You also have to tune the potential in that case.
In that case, you could, like, let's say you could hope for if your TV scale is generated, like in a pure racetrack setup from strong gauge, IR gauge effects, like gauge inner condensation only, where you get a natural, naturally pushed toward the lower scale. And then your whole potential takes place there and you find some inflection point, but you have to fine-tune the inflection point then. The point is you will not get this kind of that a large field potential becomes flat by itself if you move out. And it's then basically by the shift symmetry radiatively stabilized. A small field potential that you would have to use at low scale inflation is always some kind of saddle point of inflection point. You have to fine-tune this to be flat enough locally. And then you have to find an argument that justifies that fine-tuning. So let me show you what in this kind of setup happens and why we need this spectator field X, this extra field. So for that, we look at the supergravity scalar potential again. We have three F term squares that contribute here. And there will be, in the end, some kind of extra, non-inflationary source of Susy breaking that would lift the final vacuum after inflation to zero vacuum energy, like an entirely three-way, maybe, for instance. So there is a regime when you start phi, the imaginary part of this superfield, Chicago superfield phi, at super-Planckian waves. And x is smaller than the Planck unit. We have a regime where basically the F term of x is proportional to the power phi to the n, and scales itself proportional to the wave of the superpotential that I've written down. While all the other F terms in that regime, where t and phi are large, this is the volume modulus, it should be moderately large, and phi is the infinitely large, are subdominant. In that regime, you can both show numerically, and I show you later also the reason why you can also see analytically, this is an attractive regime. Once you are there, the field space moves there. When I give you these kind of initial conditions, it will track itself into this behavior. Now I show you why. Because once I'm in this region, it is this F term that generates the scalar potential for the inflaton. And at the same moment, this Fx squared generates, because of this quadratic term and the scalar potential in X, it generates a mass term for x that drives x to zero. So the fact that x is small, while phi initially was put at the large elongation away from zero, is dynamically basically fixes itself there. Phi rolls down slowly, and x is driven towards zero. And we want that for the following reason. Because in that regime, we have that the dominant F term scales itself proportional to the t-independent part of the superpotential. I mean, this thing is tiny. It's the flux part that will be tuned down to the size of the gravitational mass you want at the end of inflation. But this thing is now of the same size as this. There is no separation, which means that because this whole thing, I remind you, sets the height of the barrier. The barrier now is proportional to the size of the lifting F term squared, basically. Yeah. So that means that you have now the potential that you will never have the barrier too small in order to protect the modulus t from running away. This is basically the main idea. And the point is that if you would have used the F term of phi to do the same job, to give you the vacuum energy, that thing, because of its derivative, scales like W over phi. So what this leads to is that at smaller values of phi, when phi rolls down, the size of this F term blows up compared to W. You cannot use that, because this thing will overwhelm the moduli barrier eventually. This one does not. This is why we need the spectator field. This thing doesn't change the power in phi, and that's what we want. And then if you choose your parameters, and this is an order one tune. This is not something where you have to like fine tune anything. Such that the ratio between the superpotential and the F term of X, which is constant, is something like order 10, roughly. Right? Then you basically, this is what you get from, you study how much lifting you can tolerate without killing the minimum for T. Then you preserve the minimum for all values of phi. What happens is then that the barrier adjusts, and the wave of T, the point where the minimum is in T, adjusts by a huge amount, of course. But because T is massive compared to the Hubble scale, it will roll initially to its minimum and then track adiabatically, while phi is slowly rolling. And this is done basically by choosing. You choose this ratio. It's the choice of this parameter here. This is an order one quantity. This quantity that I will show you will determine the ratio between the F term of x and w, and therefore, basically, how much you lift, relatively speaking, compared to the barrier height at each given value of phi. So when you, this is some numerical example from point where we put in some numbers. When you follow the evolution of the inflaton from 50 Planck units down, you see that the F term of X that drives inflation is roughly constant with respect to W, which means that, of course, your F term becomes enormously big when you push phi out here. But the value of W also becomes enormously big. That, I mean, this W naught here is now a function of phi, as I showed you. This becomes very big. The barrier also becomes enormously high. High enough that T is not lost to run away.
So you have to stop at the gut scale or something, right?
Yeah, eventually. I mean, I cannot push it arbitrarily far. Otherwise, T becomes order one, and then...
So how far can you go with quantum detection? If you imagine that T is the size of some...
You mean...
I mean,
how small do you want to tolerate the Calabi-Yau? 10 string units in like in diameter 5, 1? For this example, this is the 60 E-fold boundary, 50 Planck units. I will show you why, and in this particular example, I mean, the power is high. It's a much bigger power than 2. There will be a catch still to the story. I'm not getting
there. Doesn't that push you way out of the ellipse?
That, of course, this model, because of this high power, is not consistent with data if you want to generate delta rho over rho via this model, directly from the implaton. There will be constraints coming from there. There is a weaker problem of the original lifting problem remaining. And how far you can go out here, I don't know, maybe 100 more, but not too much.
Not to eternal inflation.
No, definitely not. I think if you go to eternal inflation, you are by far substring in the volume already. But I mean, otherwise speaking, the wave of W becomes bigger than unity. W naught. So here is basically where the remaining catch comes from. We have fixed the problem that at large elongations of phi, the F term of X that gives the inflation and vacuum energy does not overwhelm the moduli potential. We can do that, but the F term of phi is still there. It is subdominant at large values of phi because of this relation. But at small values of phi, you still have this 1 over phi behavior. It blows up. It wants to blow up compared to the size of W. So the problem that still remains is that when the field rolls down and after it finished inflation, it's not during inflation, it's after, you're left with this problem. This is the one where you still are threatened with decompactification. Because when inflation has already ended, phi gets smaller and smaller, rolls down to its minimum. This becomes smaller and smaller. The barrier becomes smaller and smaller. But the F term of phi doesn't become small enough in the same amount. It rises compared to how this thing decreases with phi. And eventually, that could lead to decompactification. If it were not for the flux constant, W naught, the residual part that will be there when phi has shut down to zero, this thing would really blow up. But because it's there, it has a maximum. There's some area of phi where this ratio attains a peak, and then it goes down to zero eventually when phi really becomes zero. There's maximums you can evaluate, and you see that the maximum ratio you get at this peak, the maximum of this ratio, is a function of the power n of the implaton potential. So for the example that I showed, the power n was chosen such that this maximum doesn't peak at more than 10. Here, even that ratio won't lead to destabilization. Fine. But in order to have this maximum never bigger than 10, you will now have to make trade-offs. So basically, what you have to do is, in order to evaluate this ratio analytically, you plug in the constant alpha that it basically sets the scale of the inflationary potential. You fix it by demanding that at the value of phi that you need to start to get 60 e folds of slow rho inflation. You want a level of density perturbations of roughly 10 to the minus 5. This fixes you the coefficient of this phi to the n term in the superpotential, the magnitude. You know what phi at 60 e folds is. You can predict that from the slow rho equations of motion. And then you plug all of this in, and you demand that this was the formula before. You plug all of this in into this formula here, and then you demand that this ratio is, I mean, the square of this ratio should be less than 10, basically. So the ratio itself is something like less of the order of 3. And when you plot that, what you find is that when you demand a certain level of, how should I say, okay, yeah. That you get is depending on the power of n in the inflaton potential. you get different levels of delta rho over rho. If you want the final scale of the superpotential, the final scale of the gravitational mass to be TeV. If I really demand that the final scale is TeV and delta rho over rho is supposed to be 10 to minus 5, I need a very high power.
What's in those brackets?
What is it?
What's in the brackets? 5, 10 to the 7?
Oh, this is the, this labels the power for n in the superpotential for the inflaton. I mean, basically, the inflaton potential is 2 times this power. And the number here is the ratio in the size of W between when inflation starts and when inflation ends. So like at this ratio, you get a sizable hierarchy. It's like whatever, 10 to the 9 or something like that. But you come at, it comes in order to get the right delta rho over rho, it comes at the price of having a phi to the 14 potential, which is completely incompatible with data, of course. It gives you a spectral index, which is like 0.7, 0.8, something.
What is the order of magnitude for alpha, the coefficient in that term?
Oh, in order to fix, when you want to get for phi to the 14, delta rho over rho being 10 to the minus 5, then alpha is tiny. It's like 10 to the minus 16, 18.
Okay, so it is compatible with the Nesson time generator.
Yeah. I mean, that would be compatible from the size. That's true. But, I mean, this is one way to make this trade-off in order to control that this ratio doesn't really kill you at small phi. The other trade-off you can do is you say, okay, I always want to get the right delta rho over rho, but now I trade basically the final value of W naught. I mean, how small I can make the gravitational mass compared to the initial scale during inflation in terms of the function of the power. And here I can see now, okay, I mean, if I am willing to live with a hierarchy that's of the order of 10 to the 3, so I get a moderate suppression, some kind of like, I mean, that the inflationary scale during the gravitational mass during inflation is gut scale, but after it may be like 10 to the 11 GeV. Then I can live with reasonable powers of the inflaton potential that are not totally in conflict with data. But if I want to have it, again, the suppression down to 10 to the minus 15, so we get a TeV scale gravitational mass, versus gut scale during inflation, then I can again go back to these high powers. This is the trade-off that we don't, that in this model, I mean, we don't see how to get around because of this one here. It is this problem which is the residual version of the Kalisch-Linder problem.
So it's a summary that you can get high-scale inflation and low-scale CZ, but not realistically yet.
Exactly. Or we can get high-scale inflation and then an intermediate-scale gravitational mass with realistic powers. Like you could make Spitzuzzi compatible with.
That's
still high scale Suzy. No, low scale Suzy. That's not low scale Suzy.
That's high scale
Suzy. That is high scale Suzy, yeah. It's just not gut scale Suzy. You basically could okay. Like make Spitzuzzi scales compatible with the gut scale inflationary model and not and have powers of the inflaton potential that are compatible with data. That is.
I don't think it's Spitzuzzi. Spitzuzzi gauginos are very light, but here everything is going to be very heavy. Gauginos, scalars.
Well, I thought the gravitational mass in Spitzuzzi is quite heavy, right?
I mean, Spitzuzzi is just a natural model. Here, if you compute the gauginos masses, they're all going to be proportional to the gravitational mass.
In the models that
have to have some insane suppression of the gauginos mass relative to the gravitational mass.
That's true. I mean, if you do like the known constructions in this scenario, you would get other masses of the order of the gravitational mass, and that would be heavy. Yeah. Under TeV gravitational mass, you mean?
Yeah.
Not to get realistic powers. You really you have to get higher. What? To get a realistic power of the inflaton potential in this kind of class of toy models, you need to get higher.
Oh, yeah, but the higher factor of what?
I mean, I can tell. I mean, the powers become realistically here, like 2 and smaller in terms of n. So you get hierarchies of maximum hierarchy you can get with the cosmologically viable power. Is about 10 to the 3. You can suppress the gravitational mass by 3 orders of magnitude between during inflation and after inflation. That's what we can do at the moment in these models. Still, I think it should be worthwhile pointing out that the adjustment comes dynamically. We don't need to fine-tune anything in order to make this thing adjusting. all the systems, all the setups that were there before, including the racetrack setup, needed to fine-tune in order to get a hierarchy between the garbage human mouse during and after activation. So the adjustment here comes dynamically.
So that second, so 10 cubed is the ratio of the gravity mass at the inflation scale to
the post-inflation,
value at the bottom of the potential.
Yeah, exactly.
So all I'm saying is that the value at the bottom of the potential could be as large as 10 squared TeV.
Yeah, but then during inflation, it is 10 squared times 10 to the 3, which means like 10 to the 5 TeV, right? That's not compatible with that the fact that the 5 to the 4 or 5 squared model has to live at gut scale. Right? I mean, there might be, we haven't done this in this work, is maybe there are small field versions of this whole setup, of this whole general idea, that you can start at a lower scale then. I mean, then you wouldn't generate gravity waves, but that you can make this way compatible with starting at 10 to the 5 TeV and then going down to 10 to the 1 or whatever TeV, right? That may be possible. We don't know that. So, yeah, I think this is more or less, I mean, here's just, as I said, the parameters of this toy model are used for numerical purposes, where the power n is really large, but then you see that you get this huge dynamical adjustment of the wave of W while the inflaton slowly rolls. Of course, that model is cosmologically not viable. For that power, you sit probably 20 sigma out of the error ellipsis. So that was it. I'm in my end. Thank you very much for your attention.
So you didn't mention the paper by Joe Pullman and Kalush and Linda in your talk.
That was an omission. I agree.
Maybe you should also mention that idea.
That is true. So what they did is, the basic idea is the same. They want to adjust the gravitational mass running with the inflationary motion, slow roll motion of the inflaton. What they try to find is a model where T itself, or a real part of T, if you want, of the volume modulus, is the inflaton, similar to racetrack inflation, where this was the case. And what they wanted to have is here an inflection point that drives a small field version of inflation, and then a long, 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 long tail where the inflaton rolls fast, but not too fast, so that then you get a tiny minimum with a bump of order TeV at the end. And this thing is like, because it's not too steep, it will not always at least overshoot. But because this is like T is whatever, 5 here, it is maybe 100 here, you get a huge...
It's not 100, it's exponentially large, right? A large volume scenario.
Yeah, you're right. This is like they plotted this in terms of the canonically normalized field, and that is like, you're right. This must be exponentially large, but this way they get the suppression of the scale. This is like 10 to the minus whatever, 15 in the scalar potential. So W is like 10 to the minus 7 or maybe 10 to the minus 5, but here is 10 to the minus 15, the wave of W. So that here the gravitational mass is small, here it's big. So that was another attempt to do that. What they still need to do is they have to have heavy fine-tuning of the model. And I mean, it doesn't come in a technically natural sense. But it is, once you do the fine-tuning there, you get a dynamical adjustment. Yes. Thanks.
Probably one could try to improve the model to get a better situation in trade-off. But probably, if I understand correctly, the essential part of the idea is to do the inflation in F term, not in D term. Is it right?
So far, yes. Yes. I mean,
what do you mean by so far?
I mean, we haven't used a D term vacuum energy. I mean, directly, the d squared is non-zero. We haven't tried that to use the drive inflation. It's not clear to me whether you could write a d term that doesn't scale as an inverse power of the volume at the end. Right? I mean, if you could find any vacuum energy that with respect to the volumes acts like a constant, right? It just lifts the whole thing. Independent of where t is, that's much better. I mean, then you will never lose the barrier. But I don't know how to generate, and I don't know whether a D term would do that. I don't believe so, because you always have these field-dependent FI terms, typically there, and they scale like inverse powers of T or S or whatever is your modulus. and the gauge coupling G squared that is in front of D squared, right? Itself, typically, when this comes from the brain theory, it goes like 1 over T, in the real part of T, or whatever the gauge genetic function is. So you will again get inverse volume power dependence, and I think you run back into the same problem.
So you have this comment about curvitons. Can you make it fully realistic if you did that? Or?
Well, the point is, so to speak, if you use a curviton to generate a density perturbation, I mean, after converting its isocurvature perturbation into curvature perturbation, you could say that you break the link between that in high scale, in large field models, you need a very high scale to get the right delta rho over rho. So I could make a large field model sitting at a few thousand TeV. Okay. And then live with a 10 to the 3 separation between the scales and getting down to TeV.
Okay, the R would be small then.
R would be small. It's not. It would not give you R anymore. It's just in order to make a large field model running at a lower scale. Probably not a very pretty way to get around it. It's just in order to make it viable cosmologically and still getting TeV scale gravitational mass.
Has anyone tried to work with that fine-tuned model of colors blended together splitting?
Oh yes, there was a paper by Davis and Postma, I think so, where they did is they took the Kalaschlinde, I mean the racetrack, the two exponential term model, and they added basically a version of the m squared phi squared chaotic inflation in supergravity with a shift symmetric Kähler potential from Kawasaki, Yanagida, and Yamaguchi. I hope I quoted the authors correctly, from 2000. That is a, if you want, is a simplified version of this model. Is easy to see from, I mean, basically it serves as inspiration from the functional, from some parts of the setup. I hope I can hear. No, I want before. So kill this. You're left with these two terms. Forget about it as stabilization. So you remove this. And you write this as x times phi. You get a quadratic potential, right, from the fx term. And in that model, w would be driven to zero. I mean, that contribution from x phi, exactly zero. But that thing gives you m squared phi squared in a supergravity setting. And when you add back this part, and this part to get the modulus stabilization, and you stabilize not with one but with two exponentials in this racetrack sense of Kalasch and Linde, then you can show that by fine tuning, the barrier height versus big enough, basically like relatively small volumes, then you can actually make that compatible with this m squared phi squared setup.
If you allow yourself the Kalasch Linde very fine tuned,
yeah,
high supersymmetric potential barriers, then you can fit any model of inflation under those barriers. Right?
Exactly.
It doesn't have to be any. I mean, if you could model that in string theory, then you could.
Of course, then you could immediately.
Yeah.
No,
the objection there was just that it was hugely fine tuned.
It is hugely fine. I mean, the fine tuning is of order of the total size of the wave you want to have here after inflation ended, and that's roughly 10 to the minus 15, right?
Okay, but I mean, in the context of, say, these mediation models, this is kind of decoupled, but it's actually directly related to this. You want the gravitational mass to be really, really tiny, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the only model that I'm aware of that allows you to decouple the moduli masses from the gravitational mass to do gauge mediation. Otherwise, if you do gauge mediation with moduli,
then
moduli
can be
the same order of the chemical mass. So this has sort of another
variation.
Yeah, but this color from the fine tuning
one. Yes.
It's just a remark, it's not a question.
No, that's true. I mean, if you wanted to do gauge mediation, you could use that. Yeah.
So what you're saying that there are two problems, one is the barrier height inflation, and the other is the moduli mass. And they're separate problems. So this idea may help the situation for the barrier height problem. But in the end, if the system goes down to the ordinary moduli stabilized at the end of inflation, and then moduli problem is still there. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, it wouldn't be a moduli. It would be the fact that the gravitational mass and the mass of this scalar modulus are roughly the same order of magnitude.
Then that's very
and it's bad for gate mediation.
Yeah. I still say we need something like GKP, but also in the Kaler direction.
That would be the most natural thing to get rid of. If you would have power law potentials for the Kaler moduli. So, yeah, I mean, that's why in the Neil manifold case that we studied, that was much nicer, because there, type 2a, you can stabilize all of the moduli using combinations of fluxes, orientifold planes, some Wilsonine effects, if you want to have a low scale supersymmetry breaking after inflation, you need, in addition, Susi-Minkowski. That's true, or nearly Susi-Minkowski. But just to get rid of the problem with the barrier height, type 2a is a nicer place.
More general fluxes.
So the other thing is that, I wonder whether that could be usable at some time. You probably all know about or have heard about generalized geometry, right? Basically incorporating the effects of metric fluxes, Ramond-Ramond fluxes, Lebesgue-Schwarz fluxes, the metric of the manifold itself, and certain torsion classes into one big object that looks like a metric of some abstractly defined bigger space. And in terms of this bigger metric, you can define something like a generalized covariantly spinner condition, something like analog to a Calabi-Yau condition, but for this generalized geometry. And you can also demand the condition that the four dimensions be flat, Minkowski. And then you have something like a generalized Calabi-Yau condition. This has been studied by some groups. And it looks like when you do that, you actually seem to get compactifications where, because they, in a sense, incorporate p-form fluxes and metric fluxes, they remove all the moduli from the master spectrum. So they generate, if you try to reduce that to four dimensions, they generate a superpotential that have polynomial terms in the complex structure moduli and the Kaler moduli.
And the breathing mode?
Also the breathing mode, yes. As far as I know, yes.
But you're doing a large one approximation, it's complexity.
There's not controlled examples.
They are not really. The problem is.
But the generosity argument. Encouraging.
Yeah. So that is the point. If you would have control of these compactifications, understood their cohomology, for instance, to really know what the mass of the spectrum is and so on, then you could use them in principle because you have the chance to get supersymmetric compactifications with very steep barriers for all the moduli. And very small event of the superpotential, basically flat space at tree level. And that would be ideal to put any kind of high-scale model of inflation there.
You still have one more constraint that you have to satisfy. Suppose you have n moduli, so you have n equations, and then you have to impose one more constraint that W equals to zero, right, to get me positive back.
Yes, but like for the Calabi-Yau,
it's fine. It's going to be fine-tuned no matter what you do. It's fine-tuned in a Kaler-Schlinde case. It's going to be fine-tuned.
That I'm not really sure, because the Calabi-Yau condition, like for the normal heterotic string, directly leads you to vanishing W from the conformal field theory already. Right?
I mean, it's true that it's a very special choice in the overall scheme of things.
Yeah.
Most manifolds are not Calabi-Yau. So
that's true.
It's not clear what the rules are.
I mean, the most generic choice in my understanding is still that Susi is broken at a high scale, if you are, really ask me. That is the kind of generic thing I would say can come out of it. I don't see that those cases Susi is a generic prediction from string compactifications. In some corners, like purely racetrack stabilized heterotic models, for instance, it may be kind of natural, because there you have some nearly exact R symmetry, and then you're pushed to some small scale.
Okay, no further questions.